We're welcoming today Stephen Perlstein. He is a commentator for the Washington Post, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008 for commentary, writes on economics and business. He's also a professor at George Mason University, neighbors to the south. And he's joined us here today to talk about morality and capitalism. As you may or may not know, Legatum has started a program on morality and capitalism, investigating the moral basis of capitalistic economies, thinking about what went wrong during the financial crisis, and thinking about innovative new ways to move forward. As I was just talking with Stephen earlier during a short interview we did for our website, there does seem to be a lack of creative thinking on both sides of the political spectrum. A lot of regression to the mean in terms of older ideas and assumptions about our economy, the way our society is constituted, and the way that in which we understand capitalism. And this series is hoping and aspiring to think a little more creatively about reform, think a little more creatively about the role of capitalism in our societies, but also being careful to note that we believe very much in individual responsibility, but also free people and free markets, and finding ways to bring those two ideas together is very much at the heart of what Legatum does. So with that, let me turn things over to Stephen. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. I don't have a big presentation to make to you because I thought things would be better to have a conversation. There was an article that prompted my invitation. How many of you have read it? Because depending on whether you have or haven't, I can summarize. Okay. So, for a long time, particularly the libertarian wing of the conservative movement in the United States has made the argument that free market capitalism generates the best outcomes, social and economic outcomes. And obviously, coming after a period in which communism and even European socialism is perceived to have failed, this was an ascendant idea, particularly in the United States. And our capitalism has become increasingly deregulated and free market oriented. Ours was the most that way anyway, but since the mid-1970s, it has gradually gotten more so. We've gone from an era of sort of corporate and managerial capitalism that started in the 1920s and extended all the way to the 1960s and 70s to an entrepreneurial capitalism to what is best described as shareholder capitalism, in which basically companies are perceived to be run and thought best to be run to maximize the return to the shareholders, and that if you do that, you get the best economic outcome. And that still is the sort of reigning and transcendent view that sort of defines American capitalism, for good or for ill, depending on where you're coming from. The problem has become for this view, for those conservatives — I'm not one of them, those libertarian conservatives — is that after the financial crisis of 2008, which of course came after the financial crisis the tech and telecom boom and bust of 2001, which of course came after the Asian financial crisis of 1998, which of course came after what was for us a big boom and bust in real estate and banking, known as the S&L crisis of 1991, it was becoming pretty obvious to a lot of people that, in fact, this unregulated free market capitalism wasn't actually producing the best outcomes for the large number of people. And a good symptom of that was stagnant incomes and median incomes in the United States, really since the mid-80s. And the increasing share of national output that went to the holders of capital, which had been a very steady thing for a long period of time. In the low 70s, on average, through a cycle, now seem to have gone to the mid-60s. So that's a pretty big percentage of GDP shifted from labor to capital. So the couple of libertarian thinkers, including Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute and the new head of something called the Cato Institute, which is the most libertarian organization, former banker whose name I'm going to look up here because I forget it all the time, John Allison, both came out with some books sort of saying, okay, well, even beyond the question, the utilitarian question of whether free market capitalism always produces the best outcome, it's in any case morally required. And it's morally required largely because redistribution is nothing more than theft. And it's required because regulation is nothing more than not only counterproductive in terms of output, but is a theft of liberty. And so for both these reasons, capitalism, particularly this very free market-oriented notion of capitalism, is the only thing that is moral. So that's why I decided to write a story about whether that is the case or not. If you knew me, you'd know that I generally prefer the Pox on Both Your Houses school of journalism. I sort of suggested that it's an interesting question and that both sides haven't really thought it through hard enough. So on the side of the conservative libertarians, as I mentioned, 2 points. One, libertarians like to say we're not for equality of outcome, we are for equality of opportunity. But their definition of equality of opportunity is rather cramped. It's sort of, well, everyone can start Microsoft, everybody can, everyone can start or do whatever they want in the marketplace, and however they succeed, that's great. No one wants to stop anyone from doing that. They seem to sort of neglect the importance of differences in background and education, in our case in the United States, in terms of how healthy people are when they're growing up, what access they have to capital, what access they have to connections, just the role of pure luck. It's one thing to say, well, we're for equality of opportunity, but at least in our country, opportunity is becoming less and less equal as well. And mobility, which is a fairly good gauge of that, here and in other countries of the developed world, is becoming less so. We in America like to think of ourselves as having the most mobile social system, and the truth is it is not. And so that's something that that basically the libertarian conservatives get into a data game in which they say, well, actually, if you measure it correctly, we are. But I'm not going to get into that. But enough people have looked at it, including, I think, you guys, that it no longer seems to be the case. The other problem that the conservatives have is that they essentially do the old trick of assuming that which they seek to prove. And that is that they assume that the market distributes outcomes in some divinely sanctioned way, that it is a perfect reflection, your income is a perfect reflection of your marginal product, it's a perfect reflection of how much you contribute. So if you're Bill Gates, you contribute a lot, you know, and if you're the janitor at Microsoft, you contribute a little. And that this is somehow this somehow comes from God right through the market, and that distribution is right and proper. The other argument, which seems to me the better one, is that every market system is embedded in a social system, a system of laws, a system of norms and behaviors and rules, a system of power relationships that are different from one society to another. And so there is no such thing as a pure market. And once you make choices about those norms of behavior and the laws and the structure and the power relationship, you, to a large degree, have determined the distribution of income. And that is not by market. That is by human beings making social and political and legal choices. It probably was true when everyone was self-sufficient farmers that what you produced and what you produced was a reflection of, you know, your marginal product and how hard you worked or how smart you worked. But when you work for large enterprises, the distribution of income within the benefits within the institution, within the enterprise, is largely not determined by some sort of invisible hand. It's largely determined by power relationships and laws, things that flow from laws and norms of behavior. And so if you want to, you know, you need to look at those as well and not just simply say, well, however the market distributes income, it must be right because the market is free. There is no purely free market. So that's the problem on that side. The problem on the other side with my friends in the liberal movement is they rightfully perceive the need for some sort of redistribution, but they really have no set of moral principles that would tell you how much redistribution. Oh, yes, they say, we know communism failed and we don't believe in equality and we believe in equality of opportunity. But you say, so what does equality of opportunity mean? Well, public education, that's fine. And you say, well, what about public kindergarten, which we now are having a debate about in the United States? Well, they believe in that. Well, how about public preschool? Well, how about public, free public university education? And how about postdoctoral education? Where is the line? And, they have trouble answering that question because they know if they say yes to all these things, they know what it's going to cost. And yet they haven't come up with any sort of set of standards that say, well, I can tell you where the line is, or I have a pretty good intuitive thing where it is morally. Does it include, everyone having, summer recreation programs or, internships, and what about healthcare and, all sorts of things. The other problem and the bigger problem they have in terms of, money redistribution. It's easy to say that people who, live below a certain level of income in an advanced society like ours, they ought to either get money or get stuff to bring them up to that level. So people who are really poor, I think we can all agree. In fact, Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute is perfectly happy to agree to that. The problem is, what about the middle class? What is it that morally requires us to redistribute money to people who are in the middle class from people who are rich? And again, if you think it's morally required, where do you draw the line? How much? And the liberal answer to this is always more than we have now, no matter where it is. And you can't get them to say when they think it will stop. We are having big debates in our country about, what we call pensions, we call Social Security. It's like the third rail of American, you can't cut Social Security benefits to the middle class. Well, what's so magic about our current level of benefits? Why shouldn't it be 10% more? If you think it's terrible to cut it, why shouldn't it be 10% more? And if it's 10% more, why shouldn't it be 10% more than that? I mean, where do you want to draw the line? If beyond everyone should have a minimal standard of living, whatever you want to decide that that is, why redistribution beyond that? Isn't it better? What we're finding in the United States is that things are becoming so unequal in terms of market outcomes that we've probably gotten fairly close to the limit that you can do by redistributing through taxes. That if you start raising tax rates higher than we have them at the top, you are going to distort behavior. You are going to get a lot of tax gains. You are going to get you're going to get tax gains, basically. I don't think you can get people sitting home doing nothing rather than investing or rather than working. That's a conservative fantasy. But you are going to start getting distortive behavior. You're going to get people leaving the country. So the question becomes, well, maybe we should redistribute in a different way, and that is get closer to those issues I'm talking about that have to deal with the way income is distributed within the firm, whether unions are stronger, for example, than they are now. Maybe that's one way to do it, to change norms of behavior so that corporate executives don't feel it's their right. Now, the top executives of a corporation to capture 10% of the profits of the corporation every year and their tremendous salaries, change those sorts of things rather than try to wait until the market has distributed the income and then use basically the tax code to redistribute it, or to use Social Security benefits and food stamps as a way and Medicare as a way of redistributing it, because we're probably getting to the limit of that. If there's an inequality problem, we need to deal with the root causes of the inequality. Anyway, so that's basically what I said in that article. It's probably enough of my talking. I'd be interested to hear your perspective. Obviously, our country is not in the same exact place that yours is, but people do refer to Anglo-American capitalism as sort of as if it's pretty much the same. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Well, let me start, if I may, start with the first question, then we'll open it up to our guests. One thing that's on my mind, I was actually talking about this earlier today with Celia, is this question of the socialization of risk and how risk is measured and defined within our capitalist economies. And you were talking about distorted behaviors, that can come, for example, from a higher tax rate. What's your opinion on the idea of the distortion of risk when we think about how government policies are such, or politics, or just the way our economies are structured, are such that decisions or risks can be taken with capital that ultimately will be underwritten socially?
Well, I think there's a fair amount of experience and academic work on that there's an externality to risk taking by large financial institutions, and that the price associated with that risk ought to be better reflected in something, usually in the capital required to be held by the company or some sort of payment made. I think that's a fairly narrow problem. It's a big problem, but it's a narrow problem to the world of finance, and the regulators are quite well aware of it, and they're dealing with it. It was, you know, we got into that problem during the financial crisis and the previous financial crises, and we're finally dealing with it. But I think it's really specific to finance. I don't think outside of finance you see a lot of, you know, socialization of risk. You know, it's something that we're all aware of now. And, I, you know, at least in the United States, the regulators are keenly aware of that. The sort of numeric expression of it is the lower cost to borrow money of large financial institutions to other banks, for example. So we even know how big it is. You can measure it every day. You could look it up on Bloomberg. I think they're at least in our country, they're fairly determined to reduce that spread to zero by raising capital requirements of large banks until it goes away.